Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. And this afternoon, September 28, 2020, we're hosting a discussion on challenging Michigan executive orders related to COVID-19. My name is Nick Marr, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of the expert. Our expert on today's call is Patrick Wright, Vice President for Legal Affairs at Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Michigan. After Mr. Wright gives his opening remarks, we'll then go to audience question and answer about halfway through the call. So for the audience, be thinking of questions and have those ready for when we get to that portion of the call. All right. Thanks for sharing with us today, Patrick. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate the opportunity to be on. Today's case that we're going to be discussing is Midwest Institute of Health, which is a federal case, which has had its state law questions certified to the Michigan Supreme Court. Oral argument on those certified questions occurred on the 9th, and there was actually some briefing that occurred after that. And here is essentially what the case is about. Case being argued concerns whether under Michigan law, Governor Gretchen Whitmer continues to have power to issue executive orders to fight COVID. The governor contends that she can still issue these orders under the Emergency Powers of Governor Act of 1945 or under the Emergency Management Act of 1976. Both of these statutes delegate significant legislative power to the executive. The important difference in the two for one of the important differences of the two is that the 1945 Act contains no time limit or trigger, explicit time limit or trigger to give the legislative power back to the legislature, whereas the 1976 Act has a 28-day period in which the governor can essentially operate, and then she has to seek further legislative approval to continue to exercise these emergency powers. The plaintiff's principal argument in this case is that under the constitutional avoidance doctrine, these statutes must be construed to allow the Michigan legislature to end the emergency declaration and thereby reclaim its power. Otherwise, a separations of power violation under Michigan's constitution would occur due to a delegation that under Michigan law has to have both an intelligible principal and once you have a very broad delegation, you have to have substantial procedural protections. Now, the main statute that's at issue, and this is going to become important during oral argument when we discuss that, is the Michigan Compiled Laws 10.31 sub 1 of the EPGA. And the key sentence is going to be saying the following. During times of great public crisis, disaster, rioting, catastrophe, or similar public emergency within the state, or reasonable apprehension of immediate danger of a public emergency of that kind, when public safety is imperiled, then the governor gets to do various and sundry things. The breadth of these powers that the governor has are quite striking, and this is in 10.32. Michigan Compiled Laws 10.32. It is hereby declared to be legislative intent to invest the governor with sufficiently broad power of action in the exercise of police power of the state to provide adequate control over persons and conditions during such periods of impending or actual public crisis or disaster. The provisions of this act shall be read broadly construed to effectuate this purpose. So almost the entirety of the police power is given to the governor when this statute is properly triggered. So a couple of timeline matters that we'll get to. The emergency declarations in Michigan, and by the way, we're up to about, executive orders in Michigan, we're up to about 175 of them. So we're almost at, we started on March 10th of 2020. The oral argument was one day short of 180 days. So we've had about an executive order a day in Michigan. The emergency declarations, the first one started on March 10th, 2020. We had a couple of cases that day, and then they went from there. Now, what the trigger for our particular case, and we represent medical providers. So obviously the state interest that the governor is putting forward in this case, we actually sued three parties. We sued the governor, the director of health and human services, and the attorney general. This, given the fact that the attorney general and the governor disagree on a little bit of the statutory analysis, they've actually have separate counsel. The governor and the director are together, and the AG is represented separately. But starting on, so the governor, you know, the state interest that has been provided is obviously, hey, we're saving lives from COVID. We need this emergency power. We never know what's going to happen each and every day, and therefore we have to be able to be nimble and the legislature gets in our way. As of March 21st of 2020, what happened was, because we were concerned at the time about flattening the curve, lack of personal protection equipment, ventilators, not having enough medical personnel around, and just general concern about having people in the hospital when this first wave was possibly going to be coming in, Michigan shut down what it called non-essential medical procedures. So this was any surgery that could be put off was banned, and most of doctor visits were prevented. So our medical clinics in the state were shut all the way until May 29th of 2020. Obviously, you know, one of the reasons why we chose this plaintiff set is that this gave us an opportunity to say, well, wait a minute, you're trying to save lives. We're trying to save lives too. You know, there's downsides to putting off surgeries, to not getting cancer screens, to not having your diabetes monitored, all of these things that eventually did occur, and we're starting, unfortunately, to see some of those events. Michigan is currently, I mean, I think we're at 200,000 for the nation right now of COVID deaths. Michigan's somewhere around 6,500, maybe as high as 6,750 right now. So anyway, on the March 21st, 2020, the governor bans non-essential medical procedures. There's stay-at-home orders. There's new emergency declarations. I think we're on our sixth emergency declaration. But what is interesting is that on April 1st, 2020, the governor requested a 70-day emergency extension under the 1976 Act. Then after that, the legislature says, 7 days later, legislature says, okay, we'll give you until April 30th, but no more. And then April 30th comes around, and we've already had 65 COVID executive orders by this date, but the legislature still refuses to extend the declaration and essentially says that it would like to participate in setting policy for fighting COVID from here on out. And what the governor does then is she enters in three executive orders on April 30th. The first one ends the emergency under the 1976 law, as it's required by that law, because she didn't get the extension. She then indicates that the emergency remains under the 1945 law. Again, this is the law that does not have an explicit time limit in it. And then the governor also declares that there is a brand new emergency under the 1976 Act. That brand new emergency happens to be the same emergency that she had just canceled 1 minute earlier. So once this action occurred, you know, we had some questions. We were, where people were interested in challenging the governor's activities. So we had to decide the questions of, okay, well, how to sue, on what claims, and where. While this was going on, the Michigan legislature, the House and the Senate, which were both Republican majorities, and Governor Whitmer is a Democrat, the House majority and the Senate decided, okay, well, we're going to sue the governor for extending these emergencies over our decision not to. And they filed that suit on May 6th. Now, that's going to be important. Suit is going to be important because it's going to provide some context for what's going on in our suit. The next day, the governor announces her six-part plan for dealing with COVID. And the last phase, to give you an idea of how long she may be claiming to have emergency powers, requires this: sufficient community immunity and high uptake of an effective therapy or vaccine. So we could be looking years down the road. And also, there was an explicit indication that her plan could move either forward in phases, where we start in phase one and are trying to get through phase six. But she indicated you can go backwards or forward, that you could be in phase three, but then revert to phase two. You could then, you know, go to phase four. Anyway, there was a sliding scale. And until the entire state was through all of this, she was going to try and retain emergency powers. We had we talked to the legislature folk beforehand. We knew that they were going through the state court. The expectation was that they were going to essentially fill the – that their case was the one most likely to gain attention of the Michigan Supreme Court. And so much like with the recently decided Butler v. Wolf case, the federal case out of Pittsburgh that got decided on the September 14th, we wanted to have we brought the state claims as well that we thought were appropriate. But we also brought three federal claims, actually four federal claims: a due process, vagueness, a procedural due process, a substantive due process, and a Commerce Clause claim. The hope being that if the legislative suit were successful in state court, then, you know, we would go ahead and win and we wouldn't have to worry about it. If, however, the state law claims failed, we expected that we would be kind of behind that suit and that thing would end up being binding for us. So we filed our suit on May 12th. Now, on May 15th, the legislative suit was argued at the Michigan Court of Claims. It's where you file suit against the state in state court. And what had happened with our case is what the governor was doing in a lot of cases was that when she was being challenged in federal court, whenever a hearing date would appear, the executive order would be amended and she would try and moot out the controversy. So that did happen with our situation where they tried to amend the ban. As a matter of fact, we had a hearing set for May 28th, 2020. The governor a week earlier announced that the executive order that we had filed suit on was going to be changed and would no longer be effective as of 12:01 the next morning. So they tried to moot the case out. However, they left a lot of things that, like with most businesses, you would have, you know, your temperature checks, your number of people that you can have. And so there's a lot of things that the governor still was requiring, as required of each and every business. And so we still continued to have standing. So the Court of Claims on May 21st, 2020, rules that the governor does not have power under the 1976 Act because the legislature had stopped the emergency, but claims that under the 1945 Act, again, the act without any time limit, that the governor retains power to continue to issue executive orders. So What happens next is that while we are still in federal court and fighting on mootness and things of that nature, the legislature tries to do a bypass over the Court of Appeals and go straight to the Michigan Supreme Court. Given that, you know, this affects 10 million people, important state issues, many people thought that that was likely to occur. On June 4th, 2020, however, the Michigan Supreme Court issues an order denying the bypass. It's a 4-3 decision, and the Michigan House case is sent down to the Court of Appeals without an expedited briefing schedule. 12 days later, on June 16th, our federal court certifies two questions over to the Michigan Supreme Court, and these are our two state law questions. And the questions were whether under the Emergency Powers of Governor Act, which is the 1945 Act, or the Emergency Management Act, the 76 Act, Governor Whitmer has the authority after April 30th. This was the day the legislature refused to extend her deadline, the emergency declaration, to issue or renew any executive orders related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the second question was whether the Emergency Powers of Governor Act or the Emergency Management Act violates the separations of powers and or the non-delegation clauses of the Michigan Constitution. Now, the second half of that question, the Emergency Managers Act, Management Act, we are not claiming that that is a separations of powers or non-delegation violation. We are only challenging the governor's powers under the Emergency Powers of Governor Act. So just wanted to make that clear. So on June 30th, the Michigan Supreme Court accepts the certified question, sets oral argument for September 2nd, 2020. So it sets it a couple of months out. That same day, the Michigan Supreme Court orders the Michigan House case to be decided by the Michigan Court of Appeals by August 21st, and that any appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court has to be filed a couple of days before our oral argument. We filed our brief in mid to late July. Then there was an oral argument in the Court of Appeals Michigan House case. And on the 21st, that the Court of Appeals affirms that the EPGA, the 1945 Act, allows executive orders, and that's a 2-1 decision. They file the GOP majority in the House and the Senate file an application for leave to appeal at the Michigan Supreme Court, which is essentially a certiorari request, the functional equivalent of one at the United States Supreme Court. They file that on August 28th. And then we have that application, by the way, remains pending. We have our oral argument in our case, the certified questions case, on September 9th. That oral argument, which was scheduled for about an hour and 20 minutes, went for 3 hours and 37 minutes. It was covered a range of arguments, and what we are the argument that we made was essentially that we focused on the constitutional avoidance doctrine, and we said that these statutes, the 45 and 76 acts, had to be construed in a manner that would not cause a unlimited and delegation of power, of legislative power, to the executive that could continue on for years on end. Again, the governor has issued about 175 executive orders. A lot of these are forward-looking, very much policy and legislative in character. So we had, a couple of arguments about whether or not the 42 Act, whether or not an emergency in and of itself implies that there must be a time limit. We also argued that an epidemic is not like a disaster, riot, or a catastrophe, and therefore there was no power underneath that act. There was also some legislative history where we've gone through and looked at the 1945 Act, which had been issued because there were some riots. There was a race riot in Detroit in 1943 where I believe 34 people died. And part of the reason, actually the reason that this made this act was put in place was in response to that riot. And in the years post-dating between 45 and 1976, there was 10 or 11 times where this act was used whenever there was some level of quelling of violence or a labor dispute or something along those lines. There was a couple of times it was used in relation to whether or not there was sufficient coal during the winter, and there was one other time it was used related to whether or not people could fish in Lake St. Clair, which is a smaller lake over by Detroit, smaller in the sense that it's not a great lake. And that case got litigated, but nobody's able to find any of the paperwork on it during the COVID matter. So after 1976, however, almost all emergency declarations occur under the 1976 EMA. So at oral argument, one of the main questions that came out, Justice Viviano, who was very focused on this question related to the Emergency Powers of Governors Act. And again, I'm going to read this portion of the statute so you see where this comes in. During times of great public crisis, disaster, rioting, catastrophe, or similar public emergency within the state, or reasonable apprehension of immediate danger of a public emergency of that kind when public safety is imperiled. So he was very focused on the question of whether or not public safety has any kind of modifying and limiting effect on the trigger when emergency can be declared. And so we, after going through and having lots of questions on this, again, the argument went almost 2 hours longer than it was scheduled for. On that same day that we had argument, which was September 9th, the justices asked for briefing on this question. And so we all turned in our supplemental briefs on this question on September 16th. And essentially, this question gets into, when we deal with the police power, you often hear about public safety, public health, and general welfare. And the question really is this, is the term public safety define a particular category? Does it have a term of art? Does it have a meaning? Does it have a limit? Or can you essentially have any public policy term, be it public health, public safety, general welfare, and have them be fungible? So all the parties have briefed that question. Thomas Cooley is a from Michigan. He had written extensively on the police power. We had a fair amount of case law that discussed this. We think that this is a term of art, that it had a particularized meaning, that it essentially means police or fire activity, and therefore you're really limited to any kind of situation where the police must be called out to end some sort of civil disturbance. So we're waiting to hear how this case is going to be decided. We think, although I've been talking obviously about very Michigan-specific matters, we're very hopeful that it would be a good template for other people that are looking to file these kinds of challenges, because the constitutional avoidance doctrine is probably going to come into play pretty much across the board. There's going to be, I can't imagine that there's a state constitution that doesn't have a similar provision. So if we're talking these very broad powers that governors have, you're going to have to look at these statutes and see how they can be construed to see if they can if they can accept and permit this kind of long-term power. And I do want to make one more point before I go ahead and let you guys give me some questions. And that's this. In her emergency declarations, and again, we're on the seventh one of these. One of the things that Governor Whitmer has indicated is that she considers the economic effects of COVID to be one of the portions of the emergency. So she is now claiming that until the downstream economic effects, even if we get past the vaccine and the safety and having the cases at a number that she considers to be acceptable, we still have to deal with the economic effects. And until such time as she feels that all of those have been properly dealt with, she wants and is trying to continue to have this emergency power. One other little fact is that Michigan's legislature and the governor did have legislation that they entered into related to opening the school system, which is obviously dealing with this whole COVID emergency, very important as to safety, very important as to, you know, people's education, spending money, things of that nature. And so we think that this bolsters our case that we're past a situation where immediacy is needed. We think that these questions, again, you know, we're not downplaying 6,700 or deaths in Michigan and 200,000 nationally. We think these are extremely important questions, but they're no longer emergent ones. And at this point, we feel that the benefits that the separations of powers have helped put in place in Michigan and in this country over two and a change centuries, they need to be put back into place. And with that, Nick, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Patrick. We'll go to audience questions now.
Hi, thanks. Very illuminating discussion here. My question, since these timing issues have been litigated in a few other places around the country the last few months, is whether the decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court or the Oregon Supreme Court factored into the discussion that the Michigan Supreme Court has having.
You know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court was discussed a little bit. We also had in Michigan, you know, we had had the federal court try and essentially rule in the favor of plaintiffs despite the rational basis coming in. And so I think the lessons that most people that have litigated in this area have learned is that state structural arguments are probably going to do better than federal economic challenges, for sure, and even some of the fundamental right challenges. Obviously, we've got the South Bay United Pentecostal Church, and that was where Justice Roberts had indicated that he was going to give the governors a lot of leeway in fighting COVID. And then, of course, you have the Calvary Chapel case, which was part two of that. That was the casinos versus church case out of Nevada. While we are aware, and those things did come up a little bit, and we've certainly seen some citations to other states in the supplemental briefing that occurred between September 9th and September 16th, most of the stuff has been Michigan specific. Again, I do think that you know, the constitutional avoidance, you kind of see that in the Wisconsin decision, even though it was, you know, a little bit of administrative law and whether or not the particular state official had this particular power. You also saw a lot of language with separations of powers. So I do think that there is some influence there, but what influence we had was a little bit more from Wisconsin and not as much from Oregon.
Okay, we'll go to our next caller now.
Hi, my name is Larry White. I'm calling from Ankara, Turkey, but I'm a native Michigander, grew up in Sterling Heights. My question is, any thought about going the referendum route in this rather than through the courts?
Sure. In Michigan, you can has an initiative and a referendum process, and there is actually a Unlock Michigan petition drive going on right now. I think they're at 450 to 500,000 signatures. They need 340 valid signatures to get on the ballot. The problem is that they've missed this election cycle, and so what would happen is that it would go to the legislature. Well, the legislature might be Republican in 2021. It might not. If the Michigan House turns over and the Michigan House is up in 2020, the Senate is not. If the Michigan House turns over and they vote on a partisan basis in order to protect a Democratic governor, you know, a Democratic House might do that, then that would mean that the provision wouldn't get handled until the 2022 ballot. If, however, the Republicans maintain the House, then whenever it gets to them, then they can vote on it, and the governor would not be able to veto the legislation. So, you know, a little bit of a question of when Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who is a Democrat, if that concerns you, would put this and run it through the process and present it to the legislature. That is something that is still up in the air here.
Thank you.
Okay. Don't have any questions in the queue. Let's see. Patrick, we do have a question right now, actually. We'll go to it now.
Hi, good afternoon. Luke Saha calling from Flint, Michigan. First of all, thank you, Mr. Wright, for speaking to us today, and thank you to everyone at the Mackinac Center for all the work that you do. My question is that since Governor Whitmer is basically, you know, initiating all these orders on the auspices of, you know, public safety or public welfare, if the respective aspects of those orders are actually causing the public harm, whether that's, you know, economic, you could say, you know, suicides from like job loss and whatnot, or even like, you know, with the restrictions of like, you know, I guess the optional, you know, medical procedures. To kind of give you an example, my father is a surgical oncologist here in Michigan. But I mean, if he can't like do, you know, some of the surgeries that he needs to do, if those patients wait, you know, they could end up, you know, dying and waiting. So to me, it seems like almost like her claims that this is done in the name of public safety could almost be mute at that point if the results of that are actually causing more catastrophic damage. It's like it's almost as if, you know, choosing, okay, which way do you want to die? Almost.
Yeah, my wife's a physician as well. She along with the people that we're representing, weren't able to see patients in between March 17th and May 29th. So 60-something days, you know, we've started to see the bad side effects of this. All of our plaintiffs have had people that have, we've had some people die, gangrene, some really ill effects. And this kind of goes to the separations of powers component of it. You know, we have 110 representatives here in Michigan. We have 38 state legislators. We have 83 counties, 276 cities, 10 million people, 540 school districts. And the whole concept is that, you know, we're supposed to be able to have all of these areas represented, have all of their thoughts, concerns, expertise, worries brought to Lansing and the best policy made. Well, you know, one of the downside effects of what the governor did is that most of Michigan's population is located in the southeast corner. But, you know, you have these more rural places where they're getting their health care, maybe getting their surgeries, and they're unable to operate. Well, now they're under tremendous financial stress, and these places might not survive. Now, they were also very low COVID numbers in many of these localities. So we were closing places down, threatening the fiscal stability of our health systems to the out counties, and we saw some bad results, at least with a few individuals. So again, the question with the emergency declarations is the governor can act very fast, but she can also make mistakes faster. And you have to ask yourselves, okay, well, and this is implicit in your question, is at what cost? You know, she, the governor claims she saved thousands, if not tens of thousands of lives, but how many have we cost ourselves because we don't have the cancer screenings, because we didn't do the heart checkups, because you know, diabetes weren't, again, monitored, or things of that nature, you know, the everyday health needs of a state of 10 million people.
We'll go to our next audience question now.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for a great presentation. I was wondering if over the course of the briefings, did you advance a temporal limitation for the Emergency Governor Powers Act, or was it, this has just been too long?
Well, what we did try and do is we tried to graft essentially in paramateria the 1945 Act and borrow the 28 day from the 1976 Act, and essentially say that these two are covering the same subject matter. They should be read in paramateria. And what that does, court, is it prevents you from having to come up with your own constitutional time limit on the backside. Our argument is not that a delegation of legislative power is impermissible. It is that a delegation of this broad of a power, this undefined for this long, is impermissible. And one of the benefits of adopting the 28-day would be that it would relieve the court of having to come up with its own. It would make it easier for the return of the legislative power to occur, because you wouldn't have to litigate it. The legislature would be responsible for essentially most of the time getting its own power back. One of the difficulties, however, is in the Emergency Managers Act, there is a provision that says that it is not to be construed to in any way, shape, or form limit the powers that are provided under the emergency of the EPGA, the 1945 Act. So we brought that argument forward. We discussed it at oral argument. I think it is still being considered, but we will have to wait and see as to whether or not any of the justices accept it or not.
Great. So we don't have any questions in the queue right now. See if one pops up. But Patrick, do you have anything to add? Any issues you haven't covered?
I do. For people that are interested in this, and I don't think that this issue is going to go away anytime soon. If you're looking at this kind of material, if somebody asks you if they've got, you know, what's the right type of case and how and why, I really do think that it's probably needs to be what we did, a little bit by plan and a little bit by accident. And that is to end up filing more state law structural stuff. Again, we expected to be second behind the Michigan legislature suit, which is why we filed in federal court. But once the Michigan Supreme Court decided, surprisingly, that it was going to delay hearing that case and sent it back down to the Court of Appeals without an expedited hearing, then our federal court, the judge we were in front of, said, well, I'll, you know, for reasons of comedy, I will send this over to the Michigan Supreme Court. But I do think that there was an implicit, you had best decide it or else I will. And that's probably how we ended up with our date. You know, obviously, what's happening in Pennsylvania with the Butler case is of interest, because, you know, they're a little bit further along than we are. They've had their state court make their final determination as to what the legislature's powers are, and for legislative veto reasons, the governor contains and the legislature really can't pull its power back. And now they're on to that next stage, on to that federal stage behind it. So I would suggest both kinds of claims, but I do think that the state claims are a little bit more likely to be victorious.
Great. And we actually have gotten a question in the time. And
hi, Larry White again. You've talked a lot about Republican and Democrat. Is it really drawn along those lines in Michigan? Thank you.
Well, I'm hopeful that it's not. But, I mean, partisan-wise, We did have last year a very difficult budget process whereby the governor and the majority in the House and Senate did not do a particularly good job of coming to an agreement onto a budget, and then the governor's veto of a significant portion of that budget led to some ill will. So there, again, I am heartened by the fact that we had a very significant bill get through related to school reopenings. This year's budget bill has gone a lot better. The legislature, I mean, this isn't going to be an all or nothing thing. It's not the governor's way or nothing. It just probably means that there is going to be different results. Be that as it may, we are in an election year in a very hyper-partisan environment, and there are probably some partisan thoughts that are going into some of the decision making.
Okay, and we don't have any questions waiting in the queue, Patrick. So I guess I'll give you a chance for any closing remarks you might want to offer, and we can wrap up a bit early unless we get another question.
Well, just that I appreciate the opportunity to be here and share this case. We're hopeful. This is a very interesting time, both as a national election dynamic with a new Supreme Court justice potentially, and with this COVID situation going on, for all of us to sit back and examine a lot of the first principles that the Federalist Society often brings us together to debate, talk about, and explore. And so, I've been over the years, heard some great speakers and learned some great lessons and been able to apply some of that in this particular case. And so I'm thankful for, again, the opportunity to be here and share my experience.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today and sharing with us. And for the audience, thank you for dialing in. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. And as usual, be sure to keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming Teleforum calls. We have a few more this week, so we'll keep an eye on that. All right, thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.